Well, hello everyone, and welcome to tonight's free call with Jeanine Roth, in which Jeanine will answer as many of the compelling questions that you've sent in over the past couple of days as she can. A few other opportunities after tonight to connect with Jeanine. The first one coming up is Jeanine's last workshop of the year and her first one on the East Coast this year, October 10th to 12th at the Kripalu Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. You can join Jeanine for 3 days in the beautiful Berkshire Mountains, and there's only a few remaining spots. So if you're interested in finding out more or registering, you can call the Kripalu Center directly at 866-200-5203. And you can get more information about the workshop at www.kripalu.org. The Spring Retreat, which has just opened up for registration online, that's May 12th to 17th, 2015, at the beautiful Mount Madonna Center in the Santa Cruz Mountains, overlooking Monterey Bay near Watsonville, California. You can find out more about that at www.jeanineroth.com. That's GeneeNroth.com. If you can't make any of the in-person events with Jeanine, you can study with Jeanine from the comfort of your own home. Jeanine has two wonderful online retreats, one called Women, Food, and God, and the other one is about the eating guidelines. Those are 8 90-minute recorded audios that you can listen to at your own pace, where Jeanine takes you through the program and step-by-step answers questions. You also get a downloadable workbook that has summaries of all the sessions and lifetime access, so you can either listen to them streaming online, or you can download them and put them on your iPod and just carry them around with you and listen whenever you want. So secure registration for those are also online at www.jeanineroth.com. Jeanine will be joining us very shortly now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our free call. I'm very, very happy to be here with you now. Happy to be speaking with you, to you. Happy to have read through all of the questions that you sent. And as we start, and so that you can really, really be here, notice where your attention is. Notice what you're focused on. If you're sitting down, notice if you're also checking your email, writing a text, checking your Facebook page, sitting at the table, eating, thinking about food. Just notice that and see if you can really allow yourself for this very, very short amount of time, the blink of an eye, really. If you can allow yourself to have this for yourself. If you can allow yourself to have the luxury of 1 hour, possibly a little less, possibly a little more, to do one thing, which is basically to do nothing, because what you're doing is listening, not just to the words, but noticing how you feel as I speak them, and noticing the space, the background space between the words. But you can only notice that, and you can only take it in if you're actually paying attention, if you're in receiving mode, if you allow yourself to have it, in other words, which of course dovetails into the relationship with food, because so much of the time we don't let ourselves have what's on our plate. We don't let ourselves have what we already have, and we keep going for more. So in this moment, right here, right now, allow yourself to have the luxury of time for you. To listen, to be, to take in, There's nowhere else to go, and there's nothing else to do. And as you notice whether you are doing that or not, or you don't want to do that, you feel rebellious about that. No, I have to check my Facebook page right now. I have to answer this text, this email right now. Notice that as well. Don't fight with yourself on it, about it. Don't judge yourself about it. Just notice that tendency, how difficult it is for you, if it is in fact difficult, to allow yourself to take in what's good, to take in what could be nourishing, how there's an automatic response to, I don't want to, I don't have to. And then let yourself look around where you are right now, whatever room you're in. Just orient yourself, take a look around. What we want to keep coming back to in this call, and what we do keep coming back to, what I keep coming back to over and over and over again in my own life day to day, is being here, showing up basically. And again, this is on the non-food level, but it's also on the food level, because unless you show up while you're eating, there's no way to tell when you've had enough. There's actually no way to tell even when to start, no less when to stop. If your mind is always in a different place than your body, it's very difficult to be at ease in your body and in relationship with food. We're going to be practicing moment to moment to moment what the actual cure is for emotional and compulsive eating by doing it during this call, even though during this call we're not eating together. But the very skills that I'll be talking about, the practices that I do every day, that I teach my students, are the ones that I'll be continuing to come back to throughout the call. Orienting yourself to where you are, and that just gives you a chance to look around and realize, right, I'm not at the grocery store anymore, I'm not at work, I'm not asleep, I'm here. Where is here? In order to show up here, you have to notice where you are. We often go through our lives as if in a trance, with just enough attention not to bump into large objects of furniture, but not so much that we actually feel fully alive. Because we're always thinking about the next moment or the last moment, but not this one. So orienting yourself, then grounding yourself. By grounding, I mean just feeling your feet, where they're touching, your butt, where it's touching. And then sensing your body from the inside out, what's happening there. And whatever happening there, whether it's an ache or a pain or pulsing or feelings of coolness or warmth or contraction, just notice it, allow it to be there without trying to get rid of it, without making it into a problem or an obstacle. And that allowing what's here to be here creates a lot of space for you internally. It means you're not, I'm not, we're not, always working against what actually is happening. Wanting it to be different than it actually is, which, when you think about it, is such a futile attempt at making something be what it can't be because you don't want it to be what it is. The thing is, it already is what it is. So that creates an instant battle inside you. And whether you're talking about, I don't want to be the size I am. I don't want to be in my job. I wish my child didn't have an eating problem. I don't like my spouse when he or she does fill in the blank, no matter what it is. The second you start fighting with it, you become locked into it. You become wedded to it. It becomes realer and bigger, more solid, and you set up an internal war. And what we're trying to do in the relationship with food is end the war. Drop the struggle. And the only way you can do that is by not fighting with yourself. And that brings me to the first question that this is from somebody named Joanne. She says, within 18 months, I lost 120 pounds. I did it by eating only when hungry, eating slowly, and eating foods I loved. No counting calories, no weighing, no measuring. The only foods I have really banished from my life are sugary items. They fuel an addiction in me, and I realize that I can only indulge occasionally. So here is question one. Why isn't that enough? I've maintained the weight loss for 2 years, but now I want to lose more. I still have belly fat. I still have arm fat. I'm no longer in the diabetic range, and my knees and back have improved tremendously, but it isn't enough. I no longer worry about fitting into movie and airplane seats and can buy clothes in regular stores. But it isn't enough. Losing all the weight didn't solve all my life's problems. I still haven't met the man of my dreams. I still have bad days. It just isn't enough. And this relates to question two. Will I ever have a normal relationship with food? What is normal? Luckily, she says, when I binge, I come out of the binge fog faster. It isn't a week-long binge anymore like my old days. It's more like a mini binge that lasts a day or two. I'm able to get myself back on track and feel normal again, but I'm frustrated that I still think food is able to make me feel better. I know it can't. So why do I still reach for the bag of potato chips? I want to address two things that this question brings up, and I got quite a lot of questions in a similar vein. The first one is, as Joanne says, losing 120 pounds in 18 months wasn't enough. It's not enough. I didn't get what I thought I was going to get, which was to solve all my life's problems by weight loss. I still haven't met the man of my dreams. I still have bad days. It isn't enough, she says. It just isn't enough. This question of enough is so at the crux of our entire lives. And of course, it's at the crux of our relationship with food, because that's how so many of us feel. Now, she didn't address that part, that particular part that I just talked about, which is we can't get enough food. No matter what we get, it's not enough. But what Joanne did address was that feeling, number one, that no matter what we have, it's not enough. It just, as she says, it just isn't enough. I'm going to digress for a second and answer another question that somebody asked me about my own journey and how that dovetails and really integrates into Joanne's question. When I was thinking about this call this afternoon, I asked myself, because somebody did ask me that in one of these questions, what were the most significant turning points for me in my life that actually changed my relationship with food and myself. Somebody else asked me, I think it was Marie asked me, and how long did it take? And I'll try to address that now as well. But the significant, and I realized today and for the first time, that there were really two main turning points in my relationship with food and myself, and actually in being alive, because of course those have everything to do with your relationship to life itself. The first event, which I've written about a lot, was the moment when I was 28, when I had gained and lost a lot of weight. I'd been anorexic, and at that moment when I was 28, I had gained back all the weight I had lost and more, so I had doubled my weight in a couple of months. I'd been dieting or binging for 17 years, and I couldn't stand it anymore and was suicidal, a couple of days away from killing myself. And at that moment, because the suffering had gotten so intense, it seemed as if the pressure of that opened me to seeing that dieting, binging, but most particularly loathing and shaming myself had never worked. And if I wanted to stop, and if I wanted to live, which I was dicey about at that moment, then I needed to stop dieting and I needed to stop shaming myself. And also to stop binging. But more than that, I needed to start trusting myself and be curious about this relationship with food. Instead of being swung around by it and being at the effect of it, I wanted to be interested in it. I had never, ever, for all of those years, been interested in what I was doing and why, and what food was trying to tell me. And I've said this a lot over the years, that I would never choose not to have had issues with food ever. It's been the biggest blessing of my life. It's been the biggest portal of my life. It's been the way I know what I know, is through the relationship with food, because it's so concrete and it's so everyday and it's so moment to moment. You can track your desires, what you want, what you think you're hungry for. So that was the first event. The second event was in 2008, when my husband and I lost every cent of 30 years of life savings. And as I wrote in my book, Lost and Found, my husband was gone for a couple of weeks. I had to figure out how to make it through the night when we'd lost everything. Between us, we had saved almost $1 million over the 30 years, and then it was gone, and we had nothing. We had maybe $1,000, and I guess that's not nothing. That is something. But we owed a lot of money on our house, and we had a home equity loan in which we owed a lot of money on, the whole thing, leveraged, owed money. And there's a lot to say about why we did that, and I've said it all to myself already. But the turning point was when my good friends, two good friends, said to me, nothing of any value has been lost. And, of course, I didn't believe them, but I realized that if I was ever going to pay attention to what I had and what I had enough of, now was the time, because I was in shock and terror, and there wasn't any way of sleeping. The first couple of nights, I didn't sleep. I was deeply ashamed of myself for having put all of our money in one place, but also terror, in living in terror about what we were going to do. And I realized that in order to make it through, I had to focus on what I did have, not what I didn't have. What I could find, not what I had lost. And as soon, and I really mean this, as soon as I started doing that, something changed. I realized that I still had ground beneath my feet, roof over my head, sardines in the pantry. I still had arms and legs. I still had a body. I still had friends. I still had the cup of tea in my hand. I still could breathe. I could still see. There was so much that I already and still had, and that I had lived my life, my entire life. So this was 6 years ago. So I'm 63 now. I was 57 when this happened. 57 years of my life living in the state of not enough, no matter what I had, just like Joanne. Whatever she lost 120 pounds. She doesn't binge anymore except for brief little mini binges. She can buy clothes in regular sizes. It's not enough. I want more. I want more. And the portion that's on our plates, I want more of that. And I realized that I had lived like that, even with a vast amount of wealth, and it was wealth that my husband and I had, I still felt like we didn't have enough. And it had nothing to do with money, just like what Joanne talks about has nothing to do with the size of her body at this point. Nothing to do with it. What we're upset about is not what we're upset about. What we think we don't have enough of is not what it is we're focusing on. It's the habitual pattern of believing that nothing is enough because we're always focused on the future. If when my husband and I had all that money, I kept focusing on, which I did, but what's going to happen if one of us gets sick and we have to get these treatments that aren't covered by insurance, and the only treatment we can get to have our blood cleansed if we have cancer is going to be in Germany at some very expensive clinic, and we won't be able to afford the airfare or the treatment or the money, and we're going to die. This is when we still had the money. I lived in a state of anxiety about not having enough, but it wasn't just money, because I was living in the future. And of course, the future, there's no way of ever dealing with the future. There isn't a way of ever dealing with it because it's not here. And the only thing you can ever deal with, handle, know, is what's right in front of you. But because our minds have become so habituated, because inside we're like starving children, and we've become so habituated to thinking ahead for fulfillment and identifying ourselves with the past as an identity, really, that we can't be in the present moment. And as long as you are habituated to worry and be anxious, be concerned about what's happening in the future, what might happen in the future, you will never, ever be satisfied with your life in the present moment, ever. Think about it for a moment about what happens when you eat. We do this at our retreats all the time. When we eat together, everybody gets their plates of food. We sit down, put the plates in front of us, and right away, many people feel like they took the wrong thing or they didn't take enough. It's not going to be enough. The food that I have on my plate, I want more of, or I want different foods. I like my neighbor's plate much more than my plate, and I wish I had taken what she had taken and not what I took. So there's an immediate, this is before the first bite, immediate dissatisfaction. Where I am and what I have is not enough. What I saw when we lost our money, and this was truly miraculous, it really did feel like a miracle, was that every time, every single time, and because I was in such terror and shock and anxiety, and because I was alone and my husband wasn't around, I didn't have a choice, or I felt like the choices were A, go into the feeling of not enough, be anxious, be fearful, be focused on the future and what's going to happen if we get cancer and we'll need a blood cleansing treatment in Germany, or B, show up. Stay here. Do not leave even for a second the present moment. Now, of course, that wasn't possible, but that was my intention. That was my aim. That was my practice. And what I noticed was every time I did that, I was fine. Because in that exact moment, when I brought myself back, and this is what I'm suggesting that all of you do, including you, Joanne, when I brought myself back, in the moment, there wasn't a problem. I had to go into my mind to remember that we had lost our money. In the moment, I had a roof over my head. And if I didn't have a roof over my head, in that moment, I wouldn't have had a roof over my head. Or I would have been hungry. But without the story about it, I deserve better. Am I going to be forever doomed? Am I ever going to get enough? Without the story, the mental story, nothing was wrong. Now, of course, when I told my mother this, as I did write about, and she asked me how I was doing a week later, and I said I was happy, she was concerned I was on drugs. Because somebody doesn't feel happy within the space of a week after losing 30 years of her husband's and her life savings. But what I noticed was that joy and happiness and contentment were about the constant practice of bringing myself back and taking in the good of what I had. So there's a practice of enough. You could ask yourself right now, which I often ask students and workshop participants, what do you have enough of in this very second? Tell me five things. Every single one of us on this call has five things they have enough of. Now, they don't have to be things in particular. You know, the fact that you could breathe, the fact that you're above ground right now, that's good enough. It doesn't have to be, I bought a new sweater, I have enough sweaters, I have enough food in my refrigerator. Could be that, but it doesn't have to be that. Five things you have enough of right now, name them. Name them to yourself. I'll give you 15 seconds. Name them to yourself. And when you do that during the day, then what happens is that the fight with what's going on in your life stops, because you start establishing a ground of goodness in your life. You start seeing what's already good here and now, and you stop waiting for the future to bring you what you think will make you happy. You stop waiting for the future for your fulfillment. You stop waiting for things to change until you can land directly in your life. And no matter what the question is that people ask me, on some level, I feel like they're asking me, how can I be fully alive in my life? How can I show up for this life here on earth instead of missing it day after day after day? And we ascribe all of these reasons to missing it. I miss it because I use food. I miss it because I eat sugar. I miss it because I haven't met the man of my dreams. I miss it because I haven't had a child yet. I miss it because I'm not living where I really want to live. I miss it because I still need to lose 30 pounds. I miss it because I don't like my boss and I'm in a terrible working situation. I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't even need to give you 15 seconds for you to think of 10 reasons that you're missing your life, 10 things, 10 reasons why, 10 things you're waiting. And maybe it's not 10, maybe it's 2, but even if it's 2, It's too many. 10 or 2 things you're waiting to have or get or feel or look like before you can actually begin living your life. What if I told you, because it's so true, it's the truest thing I can tell you. What if I told you you don't need to wait? I know there are particulars, and it's not that the particulars, and I will address some of them tonight, it's not that particulars aren't real and aren't affecting you, they are. It's not that they don't need to be addressed, they do. I'm not poo-pooing those, but what I am saying is, you have the power right now, in this second, while you're listening to me, right now, you have the power to have and be what you think you can only have and be when you lose weight, when you meet the perfect person, when you have the perfect job, when you live in the perfect place. You have the power to do that now. And once you begin coming home to that, to yourself, to realizing that, then all those other particulars get so much easier to deal with because you're not fighting the way it is, because you're coming from a position of power, because you've landed where you actually are. And which is the only place you can be. So right now, right here, take a moment, take a breath, take a moment, and notice that. Notice the goodness that's in your life. Notice what's enough in your life. Allow yourself to look around. Open your eyes and to see what's in front of you, to take it in. You know, if there's a daisy in front of you, don't say, oh yeah, there's a daisy in front of me. I know what that is. No, you don't. You know the name of it. That's not knowing what it is. When we lost our money and I started the vigilant and fierce practice of showing up, I couldn't believe that I had been walking from my back door to my studio 100,000 times, and I had missed the sounds of the birds, the smells of the flowers, the feeling of the air on my face. It felt like I had been living with veils over my eyes, and they were suddenly removed to the sheer extraordinariness of the very ordinary, to that which was always in front of me, but I couldn't see because I was always on a trajectory. I was always in a rush to the next thing that I hadn't done that I really should do, the really, really important thing, the email to write, the text to answer, the book to write, the chapter to finish, the phone call to answer. And in that way had missed my life. So every question, and I'll start answering more right now, every question, when it gets down to its barest essentials, is how do I not keep missing my life? And we think that we'll suddenly show up if we stop eating compulsively. Well, what will stop happening is that you'll stop eating compulsively. That's all. But that doesn't mean you're going to be any happier. If you don't know how to be present now, you're not going to know how to be present 50 pounds from now. Because being present is a pattern, it's a habit. And unless you start practicing that habit, and it's very easy to do that, you sense. Use your senses to look and to listen, to feel. You see what's in front of you. And you do that a couple of times a day, just to begin with, a minute at a time. You could do that 5 times a day. That would take 5 minutes of your life, in which you were training yourself to be present, in which for a moment you could see the gorgeousness of what's in front of you, which is a position of great power, great power. So another question, this is from Anita. What on earth is the matter with me? I'm so unhappy with my body. It talks back to me all day long in the voice. It pains me every day. It cannot find clothes to wear. It feels ashamed. It wants to hide. It cries. It hurts. It is embarrassing and it's inhibiting me from living life. You see, here is that bottom line. It's inhibiting me from living life. Yet here I sit listening to part 7 of the first course in my car at lunchtime eating a Big Mac. I'm disgusted at myself, but at the same time, I make that choice to go through the drive-thru and order something unhealthy. I am numb, completely numb, and it's a roller coaster I cannot get off. I escape from the demands at work each and every lunch hour and end up back on that ride that I am stuck on. I hear what you are saying. I get it. I do. But I'm not doing the work. As bad as I really want to eat healthy and feel good, I'm just not making that connection. I find it so overwhelming. Not only am I dealing with all of these changes, but to add to that, I'm gluten intolerant as well, so I feel like I'm having to give up so much, and I have such limited food options now. I just cannot flip the switch as badly as I want to. I am on track for 10 days, which feels like a month, and the scale hasn't changed. 10 days feels like an eternity. If only I could see a substantial drop in weight, then it would propel me to go on. My body is stuck. I feel like I'm in concrete, just stuck in place with no way out. I really want this to work, but I wonder if I'm the only person failing at this, and wondering if I'm going to be fat and unhealthy and unhappy for the rest of my life. What a waste. I deserve better, and I want better. Please help. So this brings up a couple of things that many more of you asked me about. One of them, and the most obvious one, that's right off the bat, even the question, what on earth is the matter with me? I'm disgusted at myself. Right away, there's shame. What on earth is the matter with me? That tells me and that there is that voice of what I call the big person and the little person, the voice of the inner critic, the voice of shame, judgment, punishment, guilt, fear. You're never going to get this right. You're the only one failing at this. Here she is. Anita is trying hard, doing the best she can, having a very hard time at it, and she's adding what I call suffering on top of suffering. Having a hard time and then banging herself on the head for having a hard time. It's like saying, I have such a headache, and then that voice says, here, let me kick you and bang you on the head. Maybe you'll feel better. The very first thing is to realize that that voice will never lead to any kind of change. Somehow, we feel that if we kick and bang and hit and loathe and shame and punish ourselves enough, we will stop and we will change, and it won't help. It's adding suffering on top of suffering. You can tell right away that with kindness, if somebody said to you, Anita, oh, sweetheart, I'm so sorry you're having such a hard time. what do you think's going on? What makes this so hard? If somebody said that to you as a little kid when you were having a really hard time, and maybe somebody did, but maybe somebody didn't, and you hadn't learned to hide and pull yourself up and pretend, but if you could really open your heart and tell the truth, the whole world would be different. Because what would enter at that point is the kindness. The only way out of this on an emotional level, on a deep emotional level, is through kindness. And kindness is not the same as indulgence. It is not the same. When people hear me say, be kind to yourself, they think, oh, good, that means I can go eat a dozen cupcakes. That's my version of kindness. No, that isn't your version of kindness. That's your version of numbness. Numbness is not kindness. In that moment, and when you first started to learn to numb yourself, it might have been the kindest thing you could do. But as an adult, numbing yourself to yourself is not kind. Still, after you've done it, beating yourself up for doing it will not help anything. That's the moment, and there was a question, I think it was Mary, who said to me, what do you do after the binge? Well, that's the time to be most kind. That's the time to wrap yourself in your comforter. That's the time to take a nap, to have a cup of tea, to call a friend. There are places in us that are frozen in time. Places in us that because of the lack of kindness we were given and we now show ourselves have not had a chance to unlock, to thaw out, to become adults. And the only way to reach those places is through some kindness. Now, what Anita says is, I feel like I'm the only person failing at this. And this brings me to another point that I want to make. We all need support. I wouldn't recommend doing this alone. At our retreats and at our workshops, we ask people to divide up into buddies. And we ask them, and I've watched this happen over the period of the retreats now, which have been going on for 15 years, but of course I've been teaching workshops for longer than that, since 82. Although just recently, in the last 5 years, have been dividing people up into buddies and telling them how important it is to give each other support. We need somebody to be able to call when we're feeling like we're the only one. Because that sense, that belief, that's a story you're telling yourself. It's not true, of course, but how do you know that? Well, if you talk to somebody, if you have a set time to talk to your buddy once or twice a week, or you have two buddies, then you will know that. It's very important not to do this alone. The other thing that Anita said, and I really, really want to emphasize this, is 10 days feels like an eternity. If I could only see a substantial drop in weight, then it would propel me to go on. Maybe that's true. But Marianne wrote that every time she loses weight, she finds herself gaining it back. Actually, it was Kati who wrote this. Marianne wrote a version of this, but Kati wrote, before I started binging, I weighed myself and realized I had lost some pounds. That usually ruins every attempt to lose more weight. So what Anita is saying her fantasy is here, which is, if only I could lose 10 pounds, or if only I would lose more weight, if I could see a substantial drop in weight, then it would propel me to go on. Nah, not necessarily true. For everyone for whom that's an encouragement, there are five more people who, if they're not really tracking themselves and getting support, feel scared. Because our weight serves a purpose for many of us. It's a protective mechanism or defensive mechanism. And unless you realize that and begin acknowledging what your weight is saying for you that you feel like you can't say for yourself. Somebody else wrote about sex with her husband and how her weight gives her some kind of regulation or distance because she doesn't want sex as much as he wants sex. But because she feels unattractive at the weight she is, then there's a protective barrier there. She feels like psychologically it gives her some distance from him. So if she lost weight without herself having the power to say to her husband, no, I don't want sex now. I know you do, and I love you, because she was very clear in her letter. I think it was Susan who wrote this. She was very clear in her, well, actually it was her question, that she loved her husband very much, but she didn't want sex as much as he wants it. So can she say no without eating and using her weight to say no for her? That's somebody who, if she lost weight without realizing that it's her power, not the power of her weight, her power, it's the power she gives to the weight that allows her to keep her distance when she doesn't want to have sex. How about saying it? And he might not like it, but that's the truth. And so it could possibly be scary if she lost the weight without realizing that she has the permission. It's her body. She can say, no, I don't want to. And then with Kati getting scared, you know, when we start losing weight, and we've used weight as a defense mechanism or a protective mechanism, we've used it for that, and our lives and our friendships and our conversations have revolved around this identity as somebody who's struggling with their weight, when we start losing weight and or get to the weight that's our natural weight, and again, I want to say this, unless we have been really getting support for and working with ourselves the whole way, what can often happen is that we don't know who we are and we get scared. Who am I? It's like having our skin taken off. I remember feeling that when I was fat, when I was 70 pounds more than I weigh now, I remember thinking how brave it was that people walked around without 70 pounds of weight. I remember feeling like it was like they were wearing their insides on their outsides. How could they be so vulnerable? How would they set boundaries? How could they say no? And so when we use our weight for that, without learning how to say no first, then it can be scary. Now, back to Anita for a second with her question, that's where she says 10 days feels like an eternity. Well, 10 days only feels like an eternity if you're waiting for something to happen that's not happening. If you're projected into the future, sort of like the days when we used to wait, or I used to wait for the big party, the prom, when I was in eighth grade, And it just felt like it was going to be forever. And why it was forever was that I was dismissing every single day that wasn't the prom day. And so, yes, it did feel like an eternity because I wasn't here. And that comes back to what I was saying before about being present, about not missing your life. I talk about this a lot in my workshops and retreats, and I'm going to say it again, that when you listen to what people say at the end of their lives, what their 5 or 10 regrets are, and there are many versions of this, but they all have similar statements from people who are dying or people who only have a month left to live or a week left to live. They all say the same thing in terms of their regrets, those who have regrets. And they are, I didn't show up for the simple things. They don't regret that they didn't lose 10 more pounds. They don't regret that they didn't make more money than they made. They regret that they didn't notice their child's face, that they didn't spend more time in quiet or stillness, that they didn't go out at night and look at the night sky, that they didn't see what was staring them in the face until they realized that it wasn't going to be staring them in the face anymore. And then they suddenly realized, oh, it was here all along. I missed it. And the lucky ones get to show up, if only for a few weeks or a few days. The lucky ones. Because most of us keep missing our lives. So to Anita, I would say, get support and stop the voice. Read Women, Food, and God again. The chapter on the voice talks about just saying no. A simple statement to the voice is, who says to you, you're so disgusting, and you can say right back to the voice, if I'm so disgusting, then go find somebody who's not and leave me alone. So basically, go pick on somebody your own size. So stop the voice, get support, but also break the habit of looking to the future for your fulfillment. Because it's not there. Because when the future comes, unless you break the habit, it's still the present. It only comes as a present. Nobody has ever tasted, touched, experienced, or been in the future. There's no such thing as the future. Because when it comes, it's always here. It's always now. It's always this moment. And unless you begin learning how to be here now, you won't be there then. I know I just contradicted myself, but for the sake of that sentence, that's how it came out. So, Anita, Marianne, let's see what else we have here. Somebody asks, or somebody says, Deborah says, I went to your Kripalu workshop last year. I've lost 20 pounds since then. Thank you, she says. And I'm wondering what the difference is between a workshop and a retreat. So, in a big context, I want to say that a workshop like the one at Kripalu coming up in a couple of weeks, a workshop gives you a map of the territory. In a workshop, I'm presenting you with a map and I'm saying, this is where you are and this is how you get to that path, or this is how you land on the path, basically. And these are the practices. And we do enough exercises so that you get a taste of them. It's like dim sum. That's what I've never thought about that before, but it is. It's like dim sum, a taste of the whole range. You get to see what it looks like on the food level. You get a taste of what inquiry is. You get a taste of stopping the voice. You get a taste of taking in the good, of seeing what enough is. So I talk about and then ask you to in share dyads or triads or during the meals to experience that and then to tell me about it and we can talk about it. So you get a taste of it all with a lot of other people. And I can't emphasize, in fact, I meant to say this at the beginning of the call, which obviously is not the same as being in a live in-person event, but there could be as many as 2,500 people or more listening to this call right now. And when you think about that, feel it, because I can feel that now. I can feel that sense of shared hearts, of us all wanting the same thing. And whenever there's a group gathered, this is particularly true with in-person events. Whenever there's a group gathered, the possibility for change becomes exponential. It's like taking leaps because the energy of that shared group longing and intention multiplies on itself. I often remind myself after the end of a workshop or a retreat, when it's gone fabulously well, that it wasn't me who did it. It was the group. It was being in the field of so many people. The group, the field, the vortex did the work. Because you can feel it when you walk into an enlivened room. You can feel that, and it affects you. It's contagious. Bad moods are contagious, but so is life itself. Joy. When you walk into that room, when you feel the excitement, when you see people who are just like you, who want just what you want, who are struggling with just what you are struggling with, that ignites you. It sets you off. It starts you. It continues you. It's fabulous. So dim sum in a workshop, in a retreat, It is itself the territory. It's walking day by day by day by day because it's so long, 6 days, and because there's a lot of processed work and small group work and individual work. And there is processed work and individual work in a workshop, but it's different because it's not so long. So a retreat is an extended immersion into something that you already know you want. That's the path for you. In a way, a workshop allows you to immerse yourself for a much shorter time and also to see what are the tools that you want to keep practicing. And is this what you actually want to be doing? So that's the difference between a workshop and a retreat. But they're both live in person, and I would encourage you to be in person at an event because of the possibility of transformation that it offers. So somebody asked me if I could, I said I would get back to this. This was Susan. My question is, can you tell us about your general spiritual journey, not just with food, the things you did and how long it took you to feel awake and present most of the time? My answer to that is that it's still ongoing, that I'm still arriving in every moment, that it's a continual practice for me. and that my practice with food, which is what I said at the beginning of the call, was and is the same as the practice in the rest of my life. That I, with food, with what's on my plate, I try to show up as best as I can. I take a moment before I eat. I look at the food. I see if it's actually what my body wants. I stay there. I don't distract myself while I'm eating. I don't check emails. I don't answer phone calls. I don't go on Facebook. Check in to that moment of enough, and enough happens between one bite and another. In the rest of my life, on the spiritual journey, and, you know, I think spiritual is a pretty big and sometimes loaded word. What I take it to be is what can't be seen or felt with your outer eyes and touched directly with your hands. It's the world beyond appearances. And it's very much the same as what I learned through my relationship with food, which was to show up, to not eat for the hunger to come, not store for the anticipated deprivation, but to actually keep taking in the good and being where I was. And that's still in a process. Do I feel more and more and more alive and awake? Absolutely. Are there weeks and months where I feel almost ecstatic or at least very content? Yes. Do I lose it sometimes? Yes. In fact, there was another question from somebody who talked about getting it, quote, getting it and losing it. I got it, I lost it. But that's the process we're on. This isn't a straight line. For those of you, and there were many questions like this, who are lamenting that you're still doing this, or I really understood it, I really was following the eating guidelines, and then suddenly something happened, and I'm not following them anymore, and now I feel terrible that I'm not following because I really thought I was there. You were, and you still are, if you can stop fighting where you are and wanting it to be different. Remember what I said at the beginning of the call. The second you're fighting against what is, you are now, it's like you've taken handcuffs and you've locked yourself to it. You and it have become inseparable. As soon as you allow it, and what that means is notice it, acknowledge it, be kind to it and you, something shifts. What you accept fully dissolves. But that is, it's so counterintuitive that it's hard to grok. It's really hard to get that. And yet, that's exactly what we're doing here. We're in the process of paying attention to what's happening. And so notice where you are right now. We've been on the phone for an hour. So I'm going to start winding down. But where are you? How has listening to me impacted you? What do you feel now that you didn't feel at the beginning of the call? Or what don't you feel that you did feel? What is your, this isn't exactly the right language, but I don't know how to say it any differently. What's your relationship to yourself like right now? And keep looking around. Keep seeing what you see and hearing what you hear and sensing what you sense. Allow yourself to show up in your life so that you don't miss it. And there's no reason to miss it, no matter what is going on right now. I want to start saying goodnight to you, goodbye to you. Before I do, I want to thank you for coming. Thank all of you for coming, for showing up. I think just coming on the line and listening is brave and courageous. It tells me, if you're here, that that longing is true and deep. And there is no situation ever that's unworkable. No situation that's unworkable. And so if the longing is there, if the desire is there, if you get support, if you start establishing a ground of goodness for yourself, if you find a buddy and hopefully come to a live event, might have mentioned that our retreat in November is sold out with a waiting list. Our May retreat is open, and the Kripalu workshop in a couple of weeks has a couple of spaces left. Come to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Janine Roth, where I'm posting almost every single day, where many people are commenting. Be kind to yourself. Be sweet to yourself. Let yourself show up for this, your only life that you have, for this, another day, another evening above ground. So I wanted to say goodnight and have all of you say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.